So we are entering into the season of Advent together, a beautiful time of anticipating Jesus' arrival as a baby. That gives me an excuse, I feel like, to give an interesting little factoid about Wendy and I, something rather strange and unusual that we have in common. Both of us, when we were babies, had our intestines telescope in on themselves. I found this out about Wendy one day when we were going on a jog together, not that long into when we were dating, and she went to wipe some sweat off, and I noticed that she had a scar on her stomach. And she was kind of messing with me a little bit and was trying to convince me that that happened since we were in Florida when she was attacked by an alligator. And so that was left over from being chomped down on. And I was a little bit skeptical. I wasn't smart enough to say, well, let me see if there's a matching scar on your back, because the jaw have to be the thing. But, you know, I didn't want to dismiss it if it was a real story, but I didn't want to look stupid, so I just kind of tried to, like, split the difference and probably still didn't look that smart or anything anyway. But she did end up telling me that what had actually happened was that, all right, let's see what that looks like on Facebook. Sorry, everyone, if you can see me now on the recording coming back. Okay. Alright, so I did start a new thing. Alright, good. Thanks, everybody. So, telescoping intestines. This is what we're sharing. If you just joined us for that, that's going to feel like a really strange segment. But so Wendy was born 2.5 months premature. And at the time, she was actually the earliest preemie baby in the state of Florida to end up surviving. And as part of what happened and not being quite fully developed is that her intestine was telescoped in on herself, so she couldn't digest things the way that she needed to have a surgery and to correct that. And then that's where the scar came from. And she was in the hospital for actually a little bit longer than her due date in the ICU, making sure that she was taken care of and that she pulled through. And her family had to drive, I believe it was almost 2 hours in order to go and be with her. And sometimes they would stay, but sometimes they'd have to go back and forth. So it was a long few months of trial and worry to go with them. My story of having my intestine telescope in on itself was that my family was visiting one of my uncles, and I just all of a sudden started screaming and crying while they were there and spitting up blood. And so, you know, my family panicked. We rushed to a pediatrician there. It wasn't my normal doctor. And they said, we think that this is probably what's happening. We aren't close enough to a hospital that can respond to that very well. So honestly, the best thing to do, we'll call ahead to the hospital. They lived in Minneapolis near the University of Minnesota. We'll call ahead to that university hospital, which is better equipped than where you're at now. Get on a plane, get there as quick as possible, and get him admitted as soon as you can. So they sent out calls of prayer to everyone that they knew and got on the soonest flight that they could and flew back to Minneapolis. And during that flight, there was a ton of turbulence. My parents both say it was the worst flight they'd ever been on, and they were so concerned that I was already uncomfortable, I was already miserable, and I was just going to be screaming and horrible, and, you know, I didn't understand what was going on, that was going to make it even worse. But as it turns out, actually, after a little bit, I stopped crying at all. And I even was able to sleep and seemed to be doing better. And it turns out that probably what happened when they got me to the hospital and got a full scan and checked out and everything was that the plane and its all its jostling had probably shook loose my intestine, and so it was straight again and all figured out. An amazing, wonderful miracle. Very different experiences of that same intestinal condition. But sort of a strange thing to have in common. And I say this not just to have an excuse, like I said, to tell what hopefully is fairly interesting stories, but because I think that actually points us to our theme this week in Advent, to hope. It's two stories, slightly different in experience, but two stories of hope and how God can come into our lives that way. In many ways, right, the story of my miracle from the plane jostling, which, you know, by the way, gave new meaning to our family, let the term shake it off when I had something to complain about, right? That might feel most immediately hopeful. There's a crisis, and we prayed, and God very quickly, in this really unusual, miraculous way, broke in, and then it wasn't a concern anymore. When we look at Wendy's story, it might be a little bit harder to see the hope. Think of placing ourselves in perspective of her family, having months of worry and doubt and ups and downs and not a lot of certainty that things would turn out. The monotony of drudgery of sitting in an ICU. All the emotional roller coaster. And yet, hope that is formed in that circumstance, even when there's so much time, when you wonder, when you don't see where it's going to be going, may in some ways be even more substantive. It's harder to see. It's more painful to experience. It comes with scars. And yet also, that is a hope that is formative and leaves a real mark on our lives. With all that we've gone through this year, and seeing that in many ways things seem to be getting worse, how long will solutions take for all the things that we're dealing with socially, health-wise, economically, all the things that we know are part of what's been going on in our society right now? What's going to be the cost in the meantime as we wait for that solution, as we wait for that hope to come to fruition? Cost in health, cost in our economy, cost in social division. We are probably in a place of wanting our hope to be more like my airplane shape. Immediate may be strange, but let's get that done and move on. We probably feel a lot more like Wendy's family in the ICU, not knowing how things are going to turn out, feeling like it's taking a long time. This year, Aislinn made sure already that we have gone ahead and gotten our Christmas decorations all set up in our house. We've got a tree in the front window, got other things set up around. She loves to get us in the spirit of the season. And again, I'm so thankful that we have that here for our Advent season. Thanks to Mike and the Bakers again for that. And that's important, to be able to have a chance to have that familiarity, those sense of traditions probably for many of us, as other things are not new. You know, maybe some of us, though, have a little other side of the coin where we're dreading a little bit of hearing the same Christmas songs over and over again on the radio or whatever else. Although, now that we can't be in stores anymore, maybe you can at least say, well, I can have more control over my playlist, so I don't have to hear Mariah Carey every 5 minutes this whole month. But I must admit, I really love and have found significant meaning in my life from the intention of the Advent season to sit in that spirit of waiting, of longing, of anticipation in Advent, which means arrival. But our scriptures help us see not just the birth of Jesus, but all of the anticipation and the preparation for the birth of Jesus, not only with this family like we read today in Luke, but also for all of God's people, through all of the strife, the centuries and generations of ups and downs that they experienced, waiting for God's ultimate arrival in our lives. It may not always feel happy when we sit in that spirit, but I have found that it does help me when I try to get in touch with those feelings and not rush ahead to the joy and excitement of Jesus' actual arrival. That it helps me foster a little bit more thoughtfulness. It's developed in me, I think, better empathy in some situations. And it has helped me not just focus on what I want from God, but where God may seem to be guiding me. Difficulty can very easily make us feel alone or worried that all of that strife is a sign that God has abandoned us or that there's nothing good in our lives. But Advent helps us remember how many people are experiencing that all the time, and yet we can look back in Scripture. So much of Scripture is in that spirit of waiting and longing, especially in the Old Testament, the prophets, the Psalms. We can find comfort and solidarity in the people of God and seeing that God was still with them even in those moments, that God was doing something important with God's people and with the development of their faith in those struggling times of waiting and longing and noticing that things are not quite right and want God to come and do something about it. Our scriptures today anchor us in that truth. They can help us learn a deep and difficult hope, like what Wendy's family learned to develop as they sat with her as she grew up and was ready to finally leave the NICU. I think that this type of hope can actually be very life-giving to us, especially as we find ourselves in the midst of our own profound season of waiting and longing, noticing that things are not quite as they should be, and wondering when a resolution will come. Psalm 80 in particular probably felt pretty relatable this morning in some ways. How long will your anger smolder against the prayers of your people? We've had prayers and we're waiting to see many of them come to their full resolution. You've fed them with the bread of tears. You've made them drink tears by the bowlful. You've made us an object. Looks like we had a pause, but I think we're back again. We're going to hang in there as best we can, folks. I'll look for comments if something gets really dropped. So in Psalm 80, we see people pouring out their hearts of the struggle that they are facing. We can relate to those ideas of having tears, and relate to the ideas of being made an object of derision to our neighbors and our enemies mock us. And yet we call out, "Restore us, God Almighty." This probably also feels like a big contrast to the story of Zechariah. He finds out he's going to be the dad of John the Baptist, who will prepare people for the Messiah. That story probably sounds a lot more like my airplane healing. Boom, there's a baby, you're all set. Whereas the Psalm 80 sounds a little bit more like what we're probably experiencing and Wendy's family. And so we might wonder, actually, how do these two scriptures anchor us in a deep, difficult hope like Advent is meant to stir in us and that can hopefully serve us well right now? Because Psalm 80 seems despairing. Zechariah's story seems maybe a bit too easy. I think if we look at what happened to Zechariah and what it probably meant for his life, I think that we can start to see some of those connections. The ways that those two experiences, we can hold them together, actually do develop in us that deep, difficult hope. Zechariah seems like a strange story. Not only does John's arrival seem easy, but then Zechariah's response seems too skeptical, too ungrateful. And the angel says that he'll be silent because of asking that question of what's going to happen. But I believe that if we look deeper at Zechariah's experience, we can, in fact, find those resources for deep, difficult hope. Zechariah being made mute might seem primarily like a punishment, but I have a sense that it was actually something that God gave for him to have a chance to learn something deeper about his experience. It wasn't just an arbitrary suffering because of some little question that was asked. But there are lessons there that I think we can also find relatable and encouraging for ourselves. Zechariah's silence, I believe, put him in a position to learn powerful things about what gets in the way of our hope many times, how we can persevere even in those difficulties. The following feelings are things that I have to admit I have felt a lot the last number of months. And I think that we can relate a little bit, but that God indeed does offer hope for each of them. When we are missing hope, we can be tempted, much like Zechariah was, to focus on arguing and quibbling about logistics. Zechariah asked this question, "How can this be, this miracle of my wife becoming pregnant that you give?" These hows can often make us feel like we're more in control. When we don't have hope, we want to not feel like we're adrift, not feel like things are beyond us, and so we find those ways to put our attention on how can I get my hands around this? How can I figure out what's going on? And then maybe I can have control over getting the outcome and getting things the way that work best for me. And yet, it's not really often that that ends up giving us what we need either. It just gives us a temporary feeling that things are not so chaotic, because I am trying to come up with something that makes sense in my brain, rather than finding that hopeful connection to what God is doing, even if it's difficult to see and discern. God's purpose, though, when we go for questions of the how, God can encourage us to ask questions of the what deeper purpose can I learn from this thing, even that feels beyond my control. That gives us hope and a new vision of how to be God's people in the midst of our difficulty. I didn't read it, but in verses 15 and 16 of Luke chapter 1 today, the angel gives a beautiful description of who John will be and what role John will play in the big arc of what God is doing for God's people throughout history. Gives that focus of purpose that John will help people turn back to God and know that even as they feel like they're looking for God's presence to be more strongly felt when they have Romans occupying them and oppressing them, that when they decide to look at God and not look at the Romans, that God will in fact come into their lives and they will find that hope. When we're missing hope, we can be tempted to distract ourselves with busyness. Zechariah was not able to have a child for a long time. He had his important role at the temple. Likely he poured himself into that, feeling like at least I have all of these tasks that give me some status and attention and importance in my community. If I can't have a child, that's something that I can focus on. And I know that that's something that I am very prone to doing when things feel out of control. Let me just find stuff to do, and let me feel like I'm checking things off the list, and things are okay because there's those little marks of accomplishment. At the end of the chapter, we see Zechariah's wife Elizabeth saying that she had felt disgrace from her people. Perhaps the silence allowed Zechariah to turn from checking off a task list, from just doing stuff, and restoring a sense of relationships that he had around him that God had given him, and finding solidarity in struggle, recognizing that the people around us, even if we're experiencing the same thing, are a resource of strength and encouragement, even when there's difficulty. Understanding and connecting with his wife may have helped him with that, and looking for our own focus on relationships and our own focus on empathizing with and joining with the struggle of ourselves, our loved ones, and others around us actually gives us access to persist in hope over trying to solve things for ourselves that may not actually bring the solution. Lastly, when we're missing hope, we can be tempted to put all of our attention on the problem, the difficulty itself, and how insurmountable that it seems. But we have an opportunity instead to remember the legacy of God's faithfulness with people in struggle, the way that God gives comfort and dignity and ultimately solutions, maybe not in the timing or the way that we anticipate, but in the way that ultimately is for our best. And sitting in that legacy, even where the legacy was still waiting and longing, just having God's presence in some way, in some taste, before it broke in fully, that will give us a deep, difficult hope. It's interesting to me that Zechariah, as a temple leader, with an angel right in front of him, supernatural experience, he missed that connection to the legacy of God in people's lives, going all the way back to the founding of his people with Abram and Sarai, how they were promised a child even in their old age. But maybe that silence helped him remember the ways that God moved for people like him. Moved in the lives also of slaves that were delivered in the Exodus. Helped him connect also to the legacy of God moving to sustain and restore the exiles. Like in our reading of Psalm 80 today, that's a psalm of the people who were carried off from Jerusalem and Judah into Babylon and Persia, and were away from their homeland. Their cries are of that experience. Zechariah had a chance then to connect with all those things the same way that we do during this season of Advent. We can see that Zechariah's silence gave him the opportunity to truly notice and experience parts of that deep, difficult hope. Not just rushing ahead to a simple satisfaction and easy solution, apparently, in the birth of John. I think it was important that Zechariah had these experiences because part of what he needed to do, his purpose, was to pass on that sense of purpose and lesson of deep, difficult hope to John. He needed to find solidarity with his wife and the others that he served in his temple role who were still feeling like exiles and oppressed by Rome. Whether Zechariah got a baby or not, his people were still feeling that experience. And it helped him understand God's legacy of faithfulness that he could find hope in even when struggle continued to happen, because we know, as happy of a gift as a baby can be, that Zechariah would need more hope, because having John is a gifted miracle, but it also actually meant more struggle, more difficulty, more pain to come. John was going to live a hard life. The life of John the Baptist was not an easy one. He was a prophet. He struggled out in the wilderness. He was ultimately executed by powerful people because they didn't like his message. John needed to have that hope instilled in him by his family, and he could be learned even in those deep, difficult ways. And I think that's what the silence did for Zechariah. And so what Zechariah gained in that moment, I think, connected him with the exiles from Psalm 80. That psalm may seem despairing, but I believe it did, in fact, have roots of that deep, difficult hope as well. I have to remember that the people had their temple destroyed. Conquering kingdoms did that to each other in the ancient world because that was the easiest way to show you have no power, you have no hope, you've destroyed even your God. You have no access to anything beyond yourselves. And you are clearly weak to begin with because we conquered you. That was meant to be the thing that took away every ounce of hope that people could have. And yet, the people call out to God and believe that God will restore them. They had hope that it wasn't the temple, it wasn't military victories or losses that defined their God, but that they could still find hope that God would restore them and perhaps even show a different type of power, a more meaningful, deeper, more hopeful type of power. They also showed that they had hope that they could be totally vulnerable with this God. They didn't have to hide or deny or pretend with positivity what their feelings really were, but they hoped in a connection and relationship with God that would mourn with them, that could take all of their feelings and still have that important relationship, and still have that ultimate restoring. Not this dismissal because you were feeling discouraged for a time, because you were feeling longing, because you were feeling waiting, because you were noticing things are not yet as they're supposed to be, asking me as God to come and fix them. In this way, the voice of the exiles in Psalm 80 and the silence of Zechariah are both expressions of that deep, difficult hope that God offers us in this season of Advent, and especially in our season of our own waiting and longing and wondering what is going to come next. It's a beautiful picture of how these things, I think, can and should work together for us, not only as individuals, but especially as a church family in the film Moonless Sunshine. I don't know if many of you have seen that. It's one of my favorite road movies, favorite family movies. And if you're looking for something to keep busy while you're at home this Advent season, I encourage you to find a way to watch Little Miss Sunshine. It's the story of a family going cross country for a daughter's dance competition, essentially, when many of them are going through a time of crisis. The moment that brings together this silence and calling out in anguish for hope happens when the older brother of the family, Dwayne, who's been doing a vow of silence for months at this point in the movie, to try to show that he can harness control over his life. He has the goal to be a pilot. In the middle of the trip, he's doing some different vision tests just to keep himself busy, and he finds out that he is colorblind. So he was trying with silence to control parts of his life, to have a particular outcome, and then he finds out that something completely out of his control is going to get in the way of that hope's poor goal. He has a giant meltdown. At first, just trying to bang his fists and legs in the van they're driving in, but not making any noise, holding to that vow of silence. But eventually it just breaks. He can't do it anymore. They pull off to the side of the road. He runs down in a ditch just screaming in pain and frustration. It's the first sound he's made in months. He's inconsolable. All the adults in the family go down and try to fix it, make him feel better, allow the trip to go on so they can be on time for his sister's competition, but nothing works. And then, ultimately, it's Olive, his little sister, the youngest member of the family, the one who's most goofy and gregarious, constantly talking like that trope of a little kid who just wants to tell you everything in their day and take twice as long to say it as it did to actually happen. She goes down with him to the ditch and doesn't say anything. She sits next to him, silently puts her arm around her brother, an expression to him of empathy, a reminder to him of the other things that are in his life that are also really meaningful, and an acknowledgement that they can't solve everything right now, but that there is something that's going to get them through even their current experience. At that point, then, Dwayne speaks his first words in months. Simple. All right, let's go. Stand up, they hold hands together, they walk out of the ditch. He even picks her up to the last steep part, and she can't quite get her little legs to have it work. There is no automatic, final, easy answer in that moment. But there is that deep, difficult hope. From solidarity, from empathy and struggle, from a focus on the things that they can do together that are not just busyness, but that are meaningful ways to join together and support and do what God is asking them to do together. That is the hope. That's the way that we can hold both of those expressions, stepping back, taking a breath, allowing the perspective that can come from silence and listening and waiting, but also turning to people and being fully vulnerable with what our feelings and experience are, even in struggle, and knowing that God binds us all together, binds those feelings and experiences all together into something rich and powerful, that deep, difficult hope. And I don't know exactly what solution or timing that will bring as we try to live that out together as best we can, but that we will be walking with God in those moments, even in our most difficult circumstances. I hope that we can tap into that together. Yeah.